Well, let's begin formally. Today is March 5th, 2018. Beautiful Sunday. Chdav Sein Gut Meshugah, where I'm going. A beautiful Monday. Yeah, yesterday was Sunday. We were in a different world yesterday. We still haven't finished. We began with the lawyer. I have more to do on it. As I told you, what I did there in 40 minutes, I'll be happy if I finish by June 1st. We'll put it that way. Today is Monday, and the Chdav Sein Gut Meshugah, beautiful weather here, magnificent weather, and where I'm heading, they expect snow on Wednesday. So Malka said, you won't be able to speak. I said, no, we're staying in the presidential suite, which, as I recall, is in Morgenstern, and it's just a block up on the other side is the Gluck Beis Medrash. Anyway, Mura, you asked a good question. The law was as follows. Beginning with, I think the law was passed in 21, it went into effect in 22. Every country was given a quota to come to America. And if you weren't part of the quota, you could not get a visa. The East European, where the Jews were coming from, the quota was filled for the next at least 20, 30 years. But the law said if you were a clergyman and you were needed in America and you had a job, they would give you an extra, I have the exact wording in Revel, where I deal with the 1930s and everyone trying to come to America and all the pressure on Revel to send invitations that he has jobs for people. It was called an extra non-quota visa, something like that. And that's how the Rav got to America. The Rav got to America because Chicago, Hebrew Theological College, Skokie of today, requested the Rav to come and be Rosh Yeshiva. And they had papers, affidavits, that he was perfect for the position. There was no one else in America who could fill it, etc., etc. That's how the Rav got to America. When the Rav got to America, they sent the telegram to his father. We kept our word. We brought him to America, but it's 1932. It's the heart of the Depression. We can't afford to engage him. Find him a shteller on the East in your area. And unfortunately, there was Machlokes in Boston, and Rav Avraham Abba Krieger died in the middle of the Machlokes. A very prominent Rav. Some of his descendants are right here in this class. And as a result, they needed someone in Boston. And this story repeats itself. Yeshiva, there were professors, particularly among them German, well-known German professors, Professor Kirsch, others, I give the names in Revel. Revel hired them to teach at Yeshiva. Same thing with Rabbi Breuer. Revel brought him to America to teach at Yeshiva and Yeshiva College. And that's how Rabbi Breuer got to America. But the Breuers, it was, the results was on one hand, Hakarat HaTov, and that has to be a fact, that they were very dankbar, very thankful to Rabbi Revel for saving Rabbi Breuer's life. On the other hand, when Rabbi Breuer came to the yeshiva and he saw the college and the academic freedom and classes on Bialik and Acharaam, there were rumors that there was some biblical criticism going on, and particularly in Bernard Revel, which was not Bernard Revel yet, the graduate school. So Rabbi Breuer declined Rabbi Revel's invitation to teach. Now, my own relationship, I've told you many times over the decades, my own relationship with the Breuers was very interesting, because in doing my research on Rabbi Revel, I got in touch with Jacob Breuer. He ran the school that you went to, elementary school. And I have the letter, I quote the letter actually, I have a letter in my possession. He wrote a very stinging comment against the Yeshiva University. My father did not approve and does not approve now. In other words, he added on a very strong comment that YU is chutzlatum. Now he's writing to me, I'm a YU person. So it caused a bit of fiction. And believe it or not, many years later we embraced and hugged in Yerushalayim. We both had come long ways. I think he came a longer way than I did. What happened was, Max Weil, in his prime, there was no one who could organize. Do you all know Max Weil? Yeki par excellence. No one could organize better than Maxwell. So he put together a whole program, and I'm speaking on the Rav Shimon Shofel Hirsch Torim Derech Eretz, and hundreds of people. And when I finished, everyone mobbed, and Jacob Breuer comes over and hugs me. And in front of endless people, he says, Rav Rakefet, I am buying a ticket for you to go to the Heights, the KJ, and gave the talk you get here. And without batting an eyelash, I threw back at him, and Mr. Breuer, who will pay my life insurance? And he was laughing, so it was unbelievable. We became very good friends. It's a shame he didn't have a Richa Jomim here. You know, he finally married. You're aware of that. He married a widow. I think she was a second cousin. And he told me that the biggest mistake I made was not marrying. You know, you saw it. They don't have to be afraid of marrying. And you marry a nice woman, an intelligent woman, a woman with midlife. It's a beautiful thing. So he wasn't Marech Yomim, but the right-wing swing of KJ KAJ, Kilat Adat Yeshurin, it was beyond him, where they deny their own heritage. So that's one of the stories. Okay, but I want to come back here. And we're in the start of the golden period of the Agudas HaRabbanim. World War I, you have to understand, these people came from Europe. They felt the pain of their brethren. There's a big difference between someone who worked in communist Russia. Everyone I sent, more or less, was a different person when he came back. And when you read the news, what was going on, prisoners of Zion, so the average Israeli, it troubled him. But on a scale of 1 to 10, it troubled him 3, 4. Someone who had been to Russia under the communists and read what was going on, these were people we knew, it troubled you not 3, 4, 9, 10. That's the difference. Same thing with the Agudas HaRabbanim. This was Europe. This was where they came from. This is where they were nurtured. And they really felt the need. In addition, Zionism comes on the map. In World War I, if you were a Zionist, you were viewed as an extremist, as a great idealist. It was like an American going in Aliyah before 67. Before 67, an American going Aliyah, so they used to whisper, well, he doesn't get along with his parents, she doesn't get along with her parents, you understand, there are fights in the family, so they're going in Aliyah. No, in plain Yiddish, I'm a shugna. After the Six-Day War, I hate to say it, but Aliyah became fashionable. Look what's going on, and it's just unbelievable. And we're a different type of Aliyah. It's very interesting. I make one comment. Just think. The Russians conquered the land politically. The Americans never, ever got involved in politics. One out of 1,000. Not like the Russians. All the leaders of Israel today, outside of Netanyahu and Rivlin, every other leader is Russian-born, is a Russian immigrant, prisoner. They're making a big affair for Sharansky in New York. Who is Sharansky, the most famous Jew alive? And the Russians, it's amazing, they got involved. Not the Americans. I have my own theory. My theory is that the Russians, when they came to Israel and they saw the Israeli democracy, wow, this is fabulous. We're going to get involved. What a difference from here to communism. When the Americans came and saw the Israeli democracy, oh my gosh, this is democracy. This is a chaver mevi chaver system. This is a brotherhood. Who the heck wants to get involved? I was friendly with Joseph Bork. Some of you recall him, remember him. I mean, he was really a character par excellence. I told you, I was once speaking with him in Eichel Shlomo. So, and there were like 10 people around him. Each person he looked at, he broke into your native language. To me, he's speaking English. To the guy next to me, French. To the third guy, Spanish. To the fourth guy, Yiddish. To the fifth guy, German. He was had a Gewaltiger cup. So I once asked him, I said, Dr. Burg, you have traveled the world. You know what's going on in America, Canada. Why can't we have a real democracy here in Israel? And he answered me on the spot, didn't deny the question. He said, we're constantly at war. their security factors. We can't afford the luxury of a real democracy. Not a bad answer. Anyway, that's my own theory. You can take it or leave it. But the Akudis or Abundant people, they felt the pain. In addition, when they bring over the rabbis in 1924, the great Rabbanim, I ended off last week's class with a very, very important point. We don't realize it, that there always was, this was the machlokes between what Chaim Soloveitchik published, there was a critique, specifically Professor Mark Steiner. And it was an interesting critique. Mark came to me, wanted me to get involved. I said, Mark, the last person in the world I want to critique is my classmate, Chaim Soloveitchik. I don't have the ability to get involved. I don't have the time or the energy to spend in getting involved in machlekes with him. But they were both right. As you recall, Chaim's magnum opus, many people say, although I claim his work on Yainim is second to none. But as a Jewish sociologist, his magnum opus, Rupture and Reconstruction. It's many years ago already. It must be a good 20 plus years since he published, 25 years. Rupture and Reconstruction. So Chaim made the point that following World War II, there was no Yiddishkeit in America, basically. Remnants, but no real Yiddishkeit. He has interesting stories there about his father in Boston. He makes the point that a Jewish innkeeper in Boston, who was a Mechalel Shabbos, a garnish, but on Yom Kippur, he dabbled with tremendous kavanah because he saw in his youth what Yom Kippur was about. Compare it to an American, Balei Tshuva, who can barely hold a sitter in their hands on Yom Kippur. So he had some excellent, very insightful points. But the unterste Schur, the bottom line was that Yiddishkeit was reconstructed in America. And that accounts for some of the extremes. Many have followed in Chaim's footsteps and continued the theory. But rupture and reconstruction. Mark, who comes from a family that's in America, my mother and his mother went to kindergarten together. That's how far back we're talking. His mother and his aunt were like an aunt and uncle to me too, both of them. The Steiners, the Horowitzes, Zichron Tzadikim Levracha, and his family remained frum in America. Today it's 120, 130 years. So Mark said that Chaim is wrong. There were those that remained frum in America. He quoted his Aunt Irene, who I used to call Aunt Irene. Now she spoke to God every day. There's a lady born and bred in America, and like my mother, and spoke to God every day. So there's truth on both sides, but there's no question the rupture was greater than those that remained. And Chaim is correct, but when you deal with life, there are always exceptions. Now, in America, as bad as America was and as rapidly as kids were running away from Yiddishkeit, there were kids who were seeking and searching, wanted to be al HaTzadikim v'al HaChassidim v'al Zeknei HaMachah Beit Yisrael and look for the Pleitat Sofreihem. And these visiting rabbis made a great impression. And that opened up the door to Hebron in Palestine and to the yeshivat in Eastern Europe. And until the Hitler period, you had tens and tens, you probably can make a list that will come close to 50, 60 of the finest American youth that wound up in the European yeshivat, in Kletsk, in Mir, in Slabodka. As I told you last week, not so much in Telz. Telz attracted more the Yekis, the Germans, who had been exposed to Torah Derech Eretz, and Telz at least had a modicum of Torah Derech Eretz on its banner, as we spoke about last week. Okay, so that's a very, very important point. And if one day we'll talk about the yeshiva in Eastern Europe, I'll give you names and bring it to life. But probably one of the best examples, Reb Nosson Wachtvogel. Reb Nosson Wachtvogel, the Alte Mira Mashgiach, who I knew so well, he was a Ritz young man. Everyone was in the Ritz space medrash. It was the top act in town. There was no other act in town that came anywhere near it. The Meitzchiter was there, Reb Shimon Shkop was there afterwards. And he wound up in Europe, and Reb Gedalia Shoah, And you can go one by one by one, and Europe played a great role. Of course, with Hitler, it all came to an end. All right, now let us go further. In 1915, something else was established, and here you have to follow. This is a fallout from the Central Relief. Central Relief Committee gets involved with the Joint Distribution Committee. Central Relief and the Joint Distribution is trying to help every last Jew wherever he is, Ba'asher Hu Shem. It's universal. All right? These Rabbanim, Adam Karoy Veitzel Atzmo. That's very beautiful, very nice. Give, what was it, 3% of your income. Add 10 cents to every ticket for Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. Fine, good, beautiful. But they were mourning, crying, moved to tears and deep distress. Their chaverim, they left behind in Europe, the Rabbanim. And Balabatim suffered. Rabbanim suffered even more. Balabas can go and slaughter animals and take the skins off in the shuk. I'm paraphrasing the Gemara. What can a Rav do? And these Rabbanim, their families, the poverty, the disgrace for the rabbinate. And in 1915, as a fallout from the Central Relief, not replacing it, Central Relief is important, it has its role, but we have to organize a Ezras Torah, an Ezras Torah which will be specifically to help Klei Kodesh. In Europe, in Palestine, that was the goal. 1915, the middle of the year, the height of the war already, it was organized. The people who organized it also have very interesting names. I'll come back to the main person. I'll talk about him in a little bit detail in a second. But there was Rabbi Dr. Philip Klein involved, known as Hillel HaKohen Klein. He was the rabbi of Yoav Tzedek. He was Hungarian with a more broad German outlook, a very important rabbi in New York City. There was a Rabbi Yaakov Oskolsky. There's a family in Beit Shemesh. The name is Americanized. What's the name today? It's not Oskolsky. It's Americanized. Escott. That's the name. The family goes with the name Escott. They're a direct descendant of Rabbi Oskolsky. You knew the family from the east side. There was a hush of a rav on the east side. He was one of the organizers, but no one had as much influence as Rabbi Israel Rosenberg. Now, a few words on Rabbi Israel Rosenberg. It's a name that is no longer known. I don't know of any. I've never come across any direct descendants, but Rabbi I just want to see if I have any data on his life here. Rabbi Israel Rosenberg was an unbelievable activist who tremendous administrative ability. He was a Europäische Rebbe, Europäische Talmud Chacham. He rabbinated in a number of communities. He was in Maine, in Burlington. He was in Bayonne, New Jersey. He was in the New York Lower East Side area, number of different communities. But he came to the fore as a leading personality in the Agudas HaRabbanim, and he was the organizer of Ezras Torah. Now, Ezras Torah, from the time it was organized, as it continued to function, it functioned on a low light, on a low burner. They saw they needed a dominant personality to devote his life full time to Ezras HaTorah. And here you come to the most famous Rav in America until the post-World War II period. Hagoyim, he was a giant of Torah, a tzaddik yesod olam, as you will see, Reb Yosef Eliyahu Henkin. Hard to believe his great-grandchildren were killed here by terrorists. Mori Rebbe, the Rav's first grandchild, Moshe Tversky, killed by terrorists. These people paid a heavy price for being Jews, goyim, tzaddikim, part of Am Yisrael. Rav Yeshiva Leo Henkin is years 1881-1973. I'm quoting from a new edition. I had the older edition, I have the new edition now. I gave the older edition, it's in the Beis Medrash here. Kitvei Hagon Rav Yosef Elio Henkin. I'm quoting from volume one, from the introduction by his grandson. You all know him, Herzl Henkin, the grandson. His wife is very famous, the founder of Nishmat. He writes about his grandfather, Herzl Yehuda Henkin, or Yehuda Herzl Henkin. Many times he writes about his grandfather. His grandfather's years, 1881 to 1973. Now, this is someone I knew personally, Rav Henkin. He was born in Europe, the typical story, went to Slutsk, this is before Kletsk, was a Talmud Mufak there, a Talmud Chaver, Rabbi Zalman Meltzer. These were his people. Out of Kletz comes Rav Palev of Yeshiva University fame. Rav Shach comes out of Kletz. Rav Aaron Kotler comes into Kletz when he later marries Rabbi Zalman Meltzer's daughter. But this was the Chabura that he was raised in. He gets smicha from Rav Baruch Be'alevovich. He gets smicha from the Orach HaShulchan, which tells you something interesting. He was a posek mufak. He was educated. His gestalt was formed before Matan Torah, before Reb Chaim. There was a new Matan Torah that took over. Although he was born in 1881, so it means he didn't mature till 1900. By 1900, Reb Chaim was all over the place. Everyone was quoting Reb Chaim, but he already was a posek, like the old timers that came out of the original Volozhin. And his smicha is from the Orach HaShulchan, Rabbi Chiel Michel Epstein. All right, then he goes into the rabbinate, and he winds up, interestingly enough, in the Bukharan area, in the part of Russia that is remained Sephardic, survived World War I, went into the post-World War II era, and he's totally removed from the heart of Eastern Europe. A few years after World War I, he returns to Eastern Europe. I would imagine among the reasons he wanted to give his children a Litvische, more Litvish chinuch than he could get in Samarkand, that he could get in the Asiatic areas of Russia, even though it was all from, comes back to Europe, Eastern Europe, has rabbinates, and he's going from here to there, hasn't found himself, and his wife's brother is already in New York. And the brother from New York invites him to come and be a rav. This is how he can arrive with an unquoted immigrant visa. He, his wife, his young children, he comes to New York. And again, he's in the rabbinate. And this is the person they turn to in 1925 to head up Ezra's Torah. From that moment on until the 60s, when he has to cut back, late 60s, early 70s, he has to cut back on his activities, Ezra's Torah is identified with Rav Henkin. Who Rav Henkin was, stories are legendary. You don't have anyone like him. I'll give you an idea. Ezra's Torah to him meant anything. He totally abolished the idea of shluchim. Shluchim, shliach derabbanon, shadar is the abbreviation. I once took a course in Bernard Rebel Graduate School on shluchim. Maybe it should be shlichim. I'm saying the Chabad way of saying it, shluchim. We would probably say shlichim. Avraham Yari, if you've heard the name, was one of the great Talmidei Chachamim of Palestine, Israel. did a lot of research. He had a scientific chush, and he knew how to put his research together in an organized fashion. Mossad Rav Kook until today sells his volumes. They've been printed 1,000 times over. You may know the volume on Simchas Torah has a classic volume. He has 2 volumes on Shluchei Eretz Yisrael, describing the shluchim that leave Israel to collect money. The most famous of them, the Chidah, the Rav Chaim Yosef David Azulai. He died in Livorno. What was he doing there? He was went as a shliach all over the world. Of course, wherever he went, he checked manuscripts. And later, he published many volumes. I think they attribute 100 different volumes to the Chidah. And he published volumes, variant readings. You follow it. He did a great deal of research. But how did these shlichim live? They kept a percentage. Now you should know, this shiler is right in modern times. How much are you allowed to keep if you're a shliach? All right? I'm proud to say that I've raised, over the decades, generations, millions of dollars of shutami. I have not kept a penny. And by not keeping a penny, God blessed me, I suddenly started making enough of a living not to worry about a cup of coffee and a piece of cake instead of bread and water. And I'm being very serious. I'm not being facetious. I never took a penny. Not a penny. Okay. Rav Eliyashiv, Paskin Lahalach, and you can check it out, that a shlich can take up to 49% of what he raises. The idea is, if he wouldn't be there to raise the money, you wouldn't have it, your organization wouldn't have it. So be thankful he's raising the money, all right? 49%, as long as the majority goes to the organization he's raising for, he is honest. But he deserves to make a living. He's being a shaliach, he's going all over. If he wouldn't do it, you wouldn't have the money at all. Rav Henkin insisted anyone raising money for Ezra's Torah cannot keep a penny. And he became a one-man show. They used to say, the Rabbanim had an expression, Yedet Stucker is Halik. Of Ezra's Torah is the Halik that Stucker. I'll translate. Every charity is holy, but the holiest is Ezra's Torah. And now, they gave him a salary. Knew the years move on, you're linked to the cost of living. When I went into the rabbinate, my first salary between YU, being a Rosh Yeshiva, and the rabbinate that YU also subsidized, it was in brand new shul, was $8,000 a year. And $8,000, you could survive. It was a salary, all right, a big salary. When I spoke at a funeral in 1963, 64, Mr. Radin's funeral, my vice president, so his children were affiliated with the seminary, so a very big conservative rabbi was there, Louis Levitsky, came over to me afterwards and said, Rabbi Rothkopf, I want to offer you a congregation, you'll be getting over $20,000 a year. And I said to him, does it have machitza? He wanted to kill me. He said, what are you, a masochist? You want to torture your family? But all right, $20,000 a year. Today I want to see one person survive on $20,000 a year. You follow? So Link, you raise the salary. You all know Social Security goes up, or they at least tell you it's linked. It's supposed to be linked. It goes up. I get the Bituach Lumi here. It's linked. Everything is linked. They came to Rav Henkin and wanted to raise his salary. The men refused to take an extra penny. At the end of the year, they do the books. The controller comes back and says there's more money than there should be. The checks written to Rav Henkin were never cashed. You follow? And we're talking of go and find another person like this. When he started getting Social Security, he insisted on getting less money, because he was getting Social Security. When he turned 70, the Ezra's Torah voted to buy tickets for him and his wife to visit Israel. He had never visited Israel. Who visited Israel? And he refused to go. He said the organization cannot afford the money. So this was Rav Henkin. Now, I give you an idea of, here, I give you a little story, a true story. I write about it in Washington. And chaval, I didn't save the note I put up after the conversation. When I came to my first shtela, Lower Merion Synagogue, a kid out of the yeshiva, old of 23 years of age, and the shul had, I was the second rabbi. The shul in Lower Merion began in a house, a little converted house. So b'sach hakol, the shul could fit 50 people, 55 people, couldn't fit more. Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, everyone goes to Daven, at least in those years, and suddenly you have 100, over 100 people. Where are you going to put them? Across the street from us was a tremendous conservative temple, Adath Israel. See, this is my introduction to the rabbinate. Wow! Tremendous. So they were very generous. They gave us their library and take the tables out, set up the chairs, put in a machitza, do whatever you want, use it Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. Well, the shaila now comes up, can you go into a conservative temple? So I called Rav Henkin, and this is all in Yiddish, in Chabon Gitzelt, I told him the story, and Rav Henkin says, "Ich zanisht favos, ey, beben geitn da machitzu, min ken davenen, wie men daf davenen, in wie de shulchan, in wie de shulchan arach steht. Was macht das euch? Ich daven nicht im Tempel, ich daven allein, you're davening alone, you're not davening in the temple. They're letting you daven in accordance with the Vah Hashem, you're bringing in a machitzu, you follow me, Yosef?" So Rav Henkin felt that we were allowed to do it. And I put up a sign, and everyone was happy. By the way, Rav Henkin's son was a member of the shul. He was a tremendous, he was into, later he goes, he was at U of P then. Later he goes to Columbia University. He was the international professor of law, a tremendous position. You know, he had a tremendous mind. He was a Shomer Torah mitzvot. And had he devoted himself to learning, it would have been a Gadol B'Yisrael, which always troubles me. I see my grandchildren conquering the world, PhDs on PhDs, MDs, and they're all from, I have no complaint, they're all tzaddikim, many have beards, Yomo, but they're all devoted. I say to them, why are you learning? Some of them could be fabulous rebbeim. And I get the same answer, Sabu, we want to make a living. Right? They want to make a living, what can I say? You understand? The mothers tell them the stories when we didn't make a living, even though we worked hard. Okay. So his son was there. I remember Professor Levy, the famous name, Professor Leo Levy. Oh, they were so happy with the answer. But you should know, the end of the conversation was, Rav Henkin says to me, Rav Rotkoff, is like a younger of, gedenkt mir. Gedenk the Ezra's Torah, the Zeya Vichtik. Remember me, remember the Ezra's Torah. It's very important. And what he wanted for the Psak was we, the shul, should do something for Ezra's Torah. And he was like this all over. He became a focal posek. Everyone turned to him. Now, he was, when he had a principle, nothing could bend him, nothing could yield him. And here I have to tell you two stories that, one of them, I, from my own scholarship, I am talking with the Rub, I'm actually involved with. The other one I saw with my own eyes. And to give you a feeling who Rav Henkin was. And this takes us back to the Sunday class and takes us back to Yitzchak's question yesterday. Look, Chazal say, Ein Adam Oseh Bilato Bilatznut. And this means that it's a chazaka, how do you say chazaka? How would you translate it into English? It's a rule, it's a principle, it's a precedent making, that a decent human being doesn't treat his sexual relations in an indecent way, in an indecorous way. It's a serious matter. You live with a woman, but it has to be marriage. This, if we take that chazaka, and it's chazal, it's all over the place in the Gemara. Hein, hein, edi bir, hein, hein, edi yichud, hein, edo, asa, bilato, bilatznut. It's all over in the Gemara. No, if you apply that today, do you start to understand the problems we have? Take the what we spoke about yesterday, single girls going to mikvah. Guts all up him. No one wants to get married today. Today, some of the girls have to hope they'll trap a man from men that they'll be pregnant that he'll marry her. Okay? Vayu devarim me'olam. Okay? But birth control destroyed the world. Today, what's the big deal? Every kid is taught birth control at the age of 13, 14. I told him. I saw the syllabus for the Mamlakhti schools here, and even the Mamlakhti Dati schools, now they have to deal with it. And I'm told stories about the yeshiva high schools in America. It's all right. What can we do? We live in two worlds, and we have to conquer the other world, and it's not easy. So if you take that seriously here, case study, and this already began in the 60s and the 70s. Riskin's wife once said something. You don't know what went on. Don't want to repeat it all. It's not that important. But the heart of it is, this girl goes to mikveh, and she's living with this boy. And a few months later, you know, easy come, easy go, and he walks away. And then a few months later, she's living with another boy. And then finally a third boy, she's already 31, he's 33, they decide to get married. Tell me, any of them will say, Bilat Snut, this woman was married twice before, never had a get, not after the first relationship, not after the second relationship. Do you understand this story? Now, it's very, all I can tell you is, we have Poskim who Paskin, that under these cases, it's really snut, they didn't have in mind marriage, it's a different world today, a Western concept. And I gotta tell you, if the girl goes to mikveh, it makes it harder to be mekil. If she didn't go to mikveh, then you can say, no, it's a riot, what can we do, it's snut. But if she goes to mikveh, it shows a level of frumkeit, a level of frumkeit. You have no idea what halachic problem this is. Multiply this problem 1,000 times over when a couple goes through the procedure of a civil marriage. Who told them to get married civilly? Who told them? Who the heck needs consenting adults? You've heard that expression or not? It's all over the place. With the Me Too generation, everyone being challenged, every man says consenting adults. And by the way, there's some truth to it. It's not a simple matter. Some of the women have spoken out that it's not fair to accuse every man you had an affair with and tell him that he raped you, he seduced you. You walked into his office half naked. It's a frightening problem in modern times. Okay. They go through the trouble of civil marriage. Now, what does civil marriage mean? Civil marriage means the Western world recognizes you as husband and wife. In many countries until modern times, there were laws against adultery, that if you were adulterous, you were considered a sinner. There were various punishments. When it came up in court, a divorce, if you were adultery, it ruled against you. This is a marriage recognized civilly. You look into the Rambam Hilchot Ishah, Perek Aleph, Halach Aleph, he describes before Matan Torah, a man met a woman, they both agreed, and they went into a cave and had relations. There was a basic marriage there. So they now separate. Does she need a get? She wants to remarry. You should know Reb Yosef Eliyahu Henkin held 100% she needs a get. He actually wrote an entire sefer, Leib Ivri. It's been republished. It's now called Kitvei. I have it at home. He wrote an entire sefer. And you want to know more? Mori Rebbe, in 78, when I spent the Shabbat in Boston and spoke with the Rav for endless hours in learning, one of the topics I discussed with the Rav is this very shaila, because I already was teaching collegiate kids, and the shaila of girls going to mikveh surfaced already in the mid-70s. It's not ancient history. And you go back to Akedat Yitzchak, you'll see it there too. Wherever the Jews were in the big world beyond them, the whole question of sex and sexual desire and mikveh and promiscuous relationships was right in the forefront. That's the thing. I remember telling the Rav about the Akedat Yitzchak. I don't think he knew it. It was not in his world, but I knew the Akedat Yitzchak was here in Israel. It was widely quoted. And you should know, Mori Rebbe said Rav Henkin is absolutely right. Do you understand the implications? I pressed the Rav And I said, Rebbe, all right, maybe if the woman wants to remarry, it's an adulterous relationship. It's a chiyuv mita. But what about the kids, the mamzerim? They want to marry. Do we have to be machmir with them? Their mother never got to get there from the second marriage. But by a mamzer, it's only a lav. And the Rav said, you're right. Could be. There I would agree they can remarry. But the Yevid, if the woman will not get a get, for them I will agree. Quoting the Rav now. But Rav Yosef and Av, who is the great Mekil on this topic? Rav Moshe Feinstein, who lived, two blocks from Rav Yosef Eliyahu Henkin? They both lived on East Broadway, if my memory is correct. But within two blocks of each other. And Rav Moshe, the whole world rests on Rav Moshe today. All right, the Mitzvah. Yitzchak agreed ultimately. You see, the less from you were, the easier it was to say, Ein Adam Oseh Bilato Bilatz. Now, that's, you understand, Yitzchak? That's why yesterday I told you when she goes to mikveh, it makes the question much harder. You follow? The more promiscuous they were, the easier to say. And it was an amazing, Rav Moshe fought Rav Henkin fought Rav Moshe. They lived a few blocks from each other. And they were very good friends. And there were times where Rav Moshe gave a decision, I'll tell you in a second, an interesting decision, and he made it contingent that Rav Henkin has to agree with him. It's interesting. Rav Henkin did agree. It was a Shaila with Rabbi Young, had the Shaila. As I recall, it's in the Igret Moshe, the early volumes. This woman couldn't get a get, a member of Rabbi Young's congregation. Years later, she finally got a get. I think he was in Switzerland. They located him, they pressured him. He gave a get. And now she had someone waiting to remarry her. And he doesn't want to wait 90 days. You follow? Now this woman hasn't seen her husband in 2 years, 3 years. So Rav Moshe Paskind, if they do a pregnancy test, he would waive the 90 days. Okay, but it was a revolutionary psak. He didn't have to wait 90 days to be sure from who the son is, who the child is from. And Rav Henkin agreed with him. There was another case. And this may be part of the same case, but there was another case, as I recall, where I actually taught the great-grandson of the rabbi involved, that the woman got a get, sat here in this very room, and he came to me once with tears in his eyes, is it true that Rav Moshe maledicted his great-grandfather? You know, it's in print, actually. So I told him, you have nothing to worry about. If your great-grandfather could have a great-grandson like you, learning Torah, filled with Yirat Shemayim, Avat HaTorah, your great-grandfather did something right. You follow me, Morty? That's what I answered him, right here in this classroom after class. So the case was very interesting. This woman got a get. I don't want to mention the name of the rabbi, Kvod Hashem Hasdadava, but you can see it in Rav Moshe's tshuva. And he was a rabbi in Manhattan, and he was Masada the get. Years later, she's ready to remarry, and she goes to the Rav, maybe it was Rabbi Young again, I don't remember the small details. And he looks at the get. This is a piece of paper not written properly. This rabbi is not reliable. He faked you out. You need a real get. So she got a real get now, but the new chatan doesn't want to wait 90 days. So Rav Moshe was matir. Rav Henkin agreed, under such a case, where we know she's not pregnant, she can remarry. She had a get, she thought she had a get. She would never live with her first husband again, thinking it was a get, but what a story. But this was Rav Henkin, this was Rav Moshe, this was the Kotlet in Psak. More than that. And here's the apex, as far as I'm concerned. And this I saw with my own eyes, my own ears. We had a terrible instance in Israel, which I still have not gotten over, the Langer case. I have to be honest with you that just this morning, I'm so busy, I'm flying tonight, I have to call Nesher, I have to go to the Al website, And the Shvutami, the new volume, putting it together, is a very hard volume to put together because there's a lot of different material, halacha and biographies and pictures. So Alan Rosen is in charge, and he said to me he has to see me before I leave. So 8 o'clock this morning, actually came 7:45, and Yomo will testify. We worked in my office trying to, you know, put it together properly. It has to go to a designer, etc. It has to be a nice volume, Be'ezrat Hashem. Fine. The Lange case, how did these volumes of Rakafet Aaron come to be? Unknown to me, Rabbi Bednash's Chavruta from many years ago, also a genius like Rav Asaf, was listening to my shiur. And this individual, who later gets a PhD from MIT, works in Princeton, a scientist, so he got smicha now, you know, all the doctors want to be rabbis, it's not the rabbis wanting to be doctors anymore, etc., etc. So he got smicha, and he was a big Talmud Chacham. And he fell in love with my shiurim, because he was always troubled by the Lange case. And I dealt with it. And about 10 years ago, 12 years ago, he asked Rabbi Bednash to contact me if I wouldn't mind if he could contact me. And he contacted me, and he'd like to start writing up my shiurim, and this is Rakafet Aaron Volume 3. And Rakafet Aaron Volume 4, the first part is also on Hafkat Kedushin, written up from the Shurim and the Kollel. Okay. It's a, you know, he writes it from my Shurim, and then I rework it, put it into a little bit more elegant English. Make it clearer. The Lange case, why did that hurt so much? You see what Rav Avadya was matir in the Sunday class, and we have more to go. You'll see, it flows from Rav Avadya. If we take Rav Avadya and the poskim follow what he's doing, Baruch Hashem, we have a way to deal with Mamzeret within the halachic framework. We don't have to reform Judaism. And this is our tradition from time immemorial. The Lange case was a lot easier than the cases we're dealing with Rav Avadya. He was a man in Europe, a Polish guy. He fell in love, if we can call it that, or infatuated with the face of a 16-year-old Jewish girl. They ran off together. The father was a Hasidic Yid, had heart failure. His daughter is living with the guy. He insisted he'll convert the guy. And then he'll make a marriage for his daughter. He was not a rabbi, but he was a Talmud Chacham. He evidently knew what he was doing, we hope. And there was some sort of illicit conversion. And married, and they come in Aliyah. And they're living in Haifa. And the marriage breaks up. And she's remarried by a chashuv, a rav. And there's no get in between. And she has two children from the second marriage from Mr. Lange. Mr. Lange was a British soldier, I believe, was served in the British Army, was stationed in Palestine. She met him here, and they lived happily ever after. By the early 70s, these boy and girl that they had are older, serving in the IDF, and each one wants to get married, and they want to get married al pi halacha. They don't want to go to Cyprus. And the Beit Din in Petah Tikvah is worried their mamzera, the wife, the mother, never had a get. Well, an authoritative rav married them. What's he going to take an Eshet Ish and marry her to a second husband? So investigation was done, and here I have to give Rav Shlomo Gurin a lot of credit. It was established that the social workers in Tel Aviv, Meshichim Lefi Tumam, in the 1930s, taking care of this family, wrote time and again, she is married to a Polish Catholic. And they brought testimony that he crossed himself. He went to church. He ate chazer with other friends. It was unbelievable. There was also testimony that he lived somewhat like a Jew. But Rav Gurin put together a very powerful case with at least three top sveikot. He wrote a whole kuntres Who says there was a proper conversion? Who says there was a proper marriage? Who says he really became a Jew? You understand? I spoke about it yesterday. If you walk out of the conversion, all right, you're not a Shomer Shabbos, but you're a Jew, the conversion is chal. No question about it if you know the response to literature. It's not what we want, but that's a bidiyavad. But if you walk out and you go to church and you cross yourself, there's no conversion. You never gave up belief in Jesus. Those of you who have been on a beitin when the person's in the water, the questions you ask, do you renounce your belief in Jesus and the Trinity, etc., etc.? So Rav Goren put together Sveika. Was Mate the kids? Oh, what came out against Rav Goren? Rav Ovadia was silent. Even though yesterday we saw Rav Ovadia and Rav Goren agreed on another case. A more difficult case. The Lubavitcher Rebbe said, even if Rabbi Goren is right, but he got sheichet. He was given the chief rabbinate of Israel. All right, he got sheichet, but don't let two kids suffer. The Rav was, Manny Holzer, why doesn't Rebbe say so? So Manny said, you're right, the Rav agrees Rav Goren's psak is correct, but he doesn't want to get involved with the Israeli politics. I asked Rabbi Lichtenstein, what's going on here? And Rabbi said to me, very simply, they're worried that Rav Goren is like a locomotive without brakes. They were worried he's going to be mocked at this, be mocked at that. Fine, but don't make an issue where two children are suffering. No, who defended Rav Goren? Rav Yosef Eliyahu Henkin. The man didn't allow politics. He was kulo Torah, above and beyond. And this already, at the end of his life, he was interesting. He was blind. And he knew what was going on. He was totally with it. And they have a recording of Rav Goren saying, I heard it with my own ears, of Rav Henkin saying, was doing say for them? Es richtig. What do they want out of him? He's right. You have to be matir. These years heard it. You should know, when Rav Henkin died, I went to hear the Hespedim. If I'm not mistaken, I remember it was in Geula. I have a feeling it was in the original Hebron Yeshiva that was in Rehov HaYeshiva. And a big crowd there. And one of the maspidim was his grandson, Rabbi Yehuda Herzl Henkin. Now, Rabbi Yehuda Herzl Henkin himself is an interesting story. He's a Brooklyn boy. His father was not as brilliant as his brother, who was the Hamilton Fisk International Professor of Law at Columbia U. His father was a teacher in Talmud Torah, was a clay kodesh. And he grew up in Flatbush, went to Flatbush Yeshiva. How much did he know how to learn? But he learned he was the grandson closest to his grandfather. See, that always happens. There's always... I have many grandchildren. I'm close with all of them. But there's one or two that I'm closer than anyone, that they seek me out and they're with me and they're talking to me. Etc., etc. It's inevitable. You see with Reb Moshe, he was closest to Mordechai Tendler. You understand? Of all the grandchildren, Mordechai Tendler was the one who was Meshamis and Mesharis him and wrote down every word he heard from his grandfather. So that's why he calls his tshuvat, Reb Yehuda Herzl Henkin, calls his tshuvat, Shel tshuvat b'nei banim, the tshuvat of the grandson. You follow? He stresses this was his grandfather. Whatever he has from his grandfather. He never went to Yeshiva Gavoy. He didn't go to YU. He didn't go to Lakewood. It's all his grandfather. So he got up l'haspidotol, and in front of this olam, he said, and my grandfather was so above politics that he came out, and despite all that was being said in favor of Rav Goren, these children are mutalavo b'kahal. Now I can tell you, in the audience, like today, there was a tremor, there was a rechush, I don't know how to say that in English, you could feel people were whispering, and a number of Kanoyim wanted to jump up and slug him and pull down Rav Henkin Jr. And the Rosh Yeshiva, sitting Eibnun up front, signaled them, don't make an issue, sit down. Baruch Hashem, Chilul Hashem was avoided. But I was there. This was Rav Henkin. What an individual. What a person. What a Baal Machshava. What a posek. And you can understand why he had a grandson, Rabbi Yehuda Herzl, and why he has a granddaughter-in-law, Chana Henkin, who has done a lot of good for the women. You understand? This feminism has hit us between the eyes, and she has created one of the finest outlets that the woman can rise to greatness in Torah and be within Torah Tashem Tamima. It's a beautiful achievement. She's a Stern College graduate. You know that. Hannah Henkin. Your wife, Sarah?
Yeah.
Wow.
She was together in class with her 1 year behind.
1 year behind. What a lady. What a lady. Okay. Now, I want to say a few more words about Rav Henkin. He was very careful when someone contacted him to ask his shaila if he felt it was a run-of-the-mill shailot. He always said, don't you have a local rabbi? You understand? Go to your local rabbi. He always gave covered. Why are you calling me? If a shayla like this, you can ask your local rabbi. Again, if a rabbi calls him, I don't know what to do. Conservative temple, I'm the rav. I have to give an answer. I'm turning to someone greater, more learned than I am. All right, that he would answer. But he constantly covered harabbanim was so important for him. And I'll tell you something else. We spoke about this many years ago. He was opposed to she'ilat being asked over the telephone. Why? Because he said, when you're asked over the telephone, you have to answer on the spot. None of us have a perfect memory. Then you take a look in the sefer that you want, and you see, you didn't answer correctly. Who do you call? You lost the person. He says, you should make it your practice. You would say to Rabbanu, if anyone calls you with a shaila, all right, if you have to answer, answer. Take their name and take their telephone number. You may want to call them back. And I want to go one step further. The State of Israel. Are we dealing with this within the context of the Rav, but now I just want to deal with it within the context of Rav Yosef Eliyahu Henkin. The State of Israel. Do you know how much opposition there was to declaring a state? You talk about Agudas Yisrael, not just Agudas Yisrael, not just the Munkacha, the Satma, the Eder Haredit, Lubavitch, the fifth Rebbe, the sixth Rebbe, totally oppose. How can there be Jewish sovereignty? What type of Jewish sovereignty will there be? We're talking before World War II. World War II changes the world, basically, except for Satma, perhaps. But there was total opposition. You take the Rashab, the fifth Rebbe, well known. And what were they worried about? Well, what kind of state? What will be? Who was running the Zionist movement? Chaim Weizmann was a Shomer Shabbos. Ben Gurion was a Shomer Shabbos. Yitzhak Ben Tzvi happened to be a Shomer Shabbos. He and his wife were Shomer Shabbos. She was a big feminist before it was popular. But there was Shomer Shabbos 100%. That's true. Well, what kind of state will it be? Look at these people. Look at the leaders. Look at the Ganya. Look at the Kinneret. They were worried stiff. How can this is a Jewish state? There was tremendous opposition. More than that, in order to declare a state, we have to fight. To fight, we have to kill. very hesitant to teach Jewish boys to kill. May I quote Golda Meir? Golda Meir, in my wife's opinion, was the greatest, most intelligent prime minister we ever had. And for us Anglos, it was fabulous because her accent in Hebrew was worse than mine. Take my word for it. She spoke Hebrew with such an Anglo accent. You knew right away she was born and bred in Milwaukee. Not born, but bred in Milwaukee. So, where was she born? She was born in Europe, yet. Where was she born?
Kiev.
Yeah. She was born in the Ukraine. She had saw pogroms. But she grew up. She was bred in Milwaukee. So, Golda said, I quote, "I can forgive the Arabs for fighting with us. I can understand their mentality. But I can't forgive them for turning our boys into murderers." And just think about that. And you know, one of the great miracles we have here, when you look at America, just think how many guns are circulating in Israel. And thank God, percentage-wise, we have Mishugayim who killed their wives, killed their sons. A man just in Ranana just killed his son. So-called normative people. Tried to kill his wife, then he killed himself after he killed his son. Last week, it's not ancient history. But with all the guns circulating, I see my grandchildren coming home, the first thing they did, you take the cartridge out of the gun. The gun is in the safe, the cartridge is elsewhere, not allowed to keep it near each other. Who wants Jewish boys? It troubled them. So Rabbi Yosef Eliyahu Henkin, before 48, was opposed. He was not a loud anti-Zionist, but if you asked him, Hashkafas HaTeira, Das Teira, he was not in favor. After 48, he became a tremendous Zionist. So they asked him, "My Hai," this is written up. And he said, beautiful Devar Torah, you can use it. He spoke about the machlekes of the Shechem between Yaakov and his children, Yaakov and Reuven and Levi. He said, there's always been a machlekes how to deal with the non-Jews who hate us, who act against us, pogroms, etc. So there was one approach, Yaakov, if Avshtem oti b'fnei Yoshvei Haaretz, Shtadlanut, quiet, Shtile hate in Yiddish. Somehow you'll deal with them. And Shimon and Levi, Hakazonaya Shadachotainu, they're turning our daughter into a harlot. We have to stand up with dignity and fight and kill. And Rabbi Yosef Eliyahu said, there's always been a machlokes like this. Until 48, he sided with Yaakov Avinu. Now he said, I side with Shimon and Levi. This now is the right way to go. See, he was such a personality, so honest, so moving. Wow.
The rub also changed.
Well, we'll talk about that at the Jewish Center a week from now, Be'ezrat Hashem. That's
not in the Jewish Center.
Believe me, I spoke of, say that my class is ongoing here in the Kollel since 78. I spoke about it in great length in the Kollel. Leave it be for now. I actually published in Torah to Go about the Rav. Someone wrote up the class I gave. All right. But Rav Henkin, what a personality, what an individual, what an Ezras Torah. It still functions until today, but obviously without Rav Henkin, it's not the Ezras Torah that was the holiest of the holy. Everyone stood in awe. His relationships to the yeshiva were magnificent and beautiful. He was very cognizant of the Western world and appreciated the fact that we've moved into a new situation, and Torah, like the Rav, v'yidku l'rov b'kerev ha'aretz, v'yikarehem shmi v'shem avotai v'ham v'yitzchak, We have to be Jews, but we have to live the Kerev Haaretz. And I'll tell you tremendous Derech Haaretz. Oh, yeah, tremendous Derech Haaretz. I'll tell you a story now. You'll understand yourself what his relationship was to Yeshiva. Baruch Ato Adonai Elohim Melech Olam Shehakol Nehyeh Bedvaro. Rabbi Aaron Cutler comes to America in the mid-30s to raise funds. It has to be about 37, I would imagine. And 35, I have the exact date in the Revel. And there's already a lot of Lashon Hara against the Yeshiva, a lot of opposition. We'll talk about this with the Gerus Rabbanim, but not yet. But you have to understand that there's now challenges to the Yeshiva. Torah Vadas is on the map. Rav Shlomo Hyman has come to America. They have a top Rosh Yeshiva. He's a Talmud Mufak of Baruch Be'er Leibovitz. He died young. Many people came to New York to study by Rav Shlomo Hyman. When he died, they went to YU to study with the Rav. You follow? YU picked up Lo Aleinu because of his premature death. I'll give you a simple example. Rav Moshe Horowitz, the founding dean of BMT, the founding dean of the original institution that exports Torah to the Western world. That changed the course of Torah history. Torah Shragar, there are 1,001 other institutions today, but it all goes back to BMT, Beit Medrash LaTorah. Whitey Horowitz came to New York from Chicago to study at Torah Vadas. Then Rav Shlomo Hyman died, and he knew Rav David Lifshitz had gone to YU from Chicago. 44, 45, he went to YU, and he became a Talmud of the Rav afterwards. But there was no opposition to Yeshiva. So Rav Aaron Cutler, who we know had extreme positions against secular study, so Rabbi Aaron Cutler, Rabbi Revel invites him to give a shiur, and Rabbi Moshe Aaron Poleyev, who I told you was a Kletzka, he was a Slutzka before Kletz, but it's all part of the same Chabura. So Rabbi Revel sends Rabbi Poleyev to influence Rabbi Aaron to come give a shiur. And Rabbi Aaron doesn't know what to do. And in walks Rabbi Yosef Eliyahu Henkin, who also was a Slutska. And Rabbi Aaron asked him, and he was, you know, elder, he was already revered in America. Rabbi Aaron asked Rav Henkin, Vasalachtan, what should I do? And Rav Henkin says, Vas is the Shiloh, what's the question? And the Rav says, well, and Rabbi Aaron Cutler says, well, this critique, that critique. And Rav Henkin says, I heard this from Rav Paleyev, word by word. Okay? Ish mi pi ish. I'm repeating the name of Rav Moshe Aaron Poleyev. Rav Poleyev said to him, the yeshiva is nisht anderish, the ala yeshiva. The zelba teira, the zelba kedusha, the zelba mahut. It's exactly like any other yeshiva. The same Torah, the same Yirat Shemayim, the same gestalt. Aba, now hataychet a college. Min in America, says Nish Slutska. We have a college, and that we have to have in America. It's not Slutz. You see, that was Rav Henkin. And Rav Aaron, as a result, came and gave Shayur in the yeshiva. The one who refused to give Shir in the yeshiva was a few years later, 38, was Rav Elchanan Wasserman. By that time, the heat against the yeshiva was so strong, so powerful, so intense, that the Ochanan desisted. There were big balabatim, frum, who gave heavy money to the yeshiva. Rav Hirsch Manashevitz got in touch, or Rav Bernard, you got to look into Revel, it may have been his father, Bernard Manashevitz, but I think it was Hirsch Manashevitz, the son, got in touch with Rav Elchanan Wasserman. Why don't you want to give a shiur in the yeshiva? And that's the famous letter Rav Elchanan wrote, that they teach up because courses, again, Bialik, Chara'am, who knows what else they teach, refuse to give a shir. And that's the famous letter I reproduce in the Silva era, a letter which we have the original in Rabbi Chanan's handwriting, because people hear the letter, they don't believe it. I have the original letter in my files, a Xerox of the original letter in Rabbi Chanan's handwriting on the stationery of the Branovich Yeshiva, where this kid has this invitation, non quota, to come study at Yeshiva's Rav Yiskel Chachan from Rabbi Revel. And he asked Rabbi Chanan what to do. And Rabbi Chanan tells him absolutely not to accept it. You're looking to save yourself physically and you'll kill yourself spiritually. And that's that famous letter from Rabbi Chanan. And you see, it's all a result. America, the visit, it begins with Rabbarin and Tul Rabbarin Kotlin. No one ever said no. But Rabbi Chanan already not just said no, but no one could budge him, no one could influence him. And that's Rabbi Chanan. And I can tell you one more story. I've said it before, I've wrote about it, I've written it up. It's the classic story here in Israel. It just came to the fore. The classic story where he spent all his time in Williamsburg, Teruah Hadas, and the wealthy Balabas was making a wedding. And you know, people want Rabbanim, well-known Rabbanim should be at the wedding. So this person came to Rabbi Chanan, Rebbe, that given Teruah Hadas 100 tala, the Rosh Yeshiva Zazayim Mesad HaKadushin, my tochter hot kasna, I'll give Teruah Hadas $100, my daughter is marrying, and I want the Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbi Chanan, Masada Kedushin. So Rabbi Chanan goes, and he's Masada Kedushin. And Minhag America, these are Shomer Shabbos people, maybe young Israel people, whatever, second generation. Minhag America, after they break the glass and everyone says Mazel Tov, the Chatan kisses the bride. And Rabbi Chanan was very upset. So, American Talmidim went over to him, Rebbe, what are you so upset about? Was happened breakers, I say, what are you so upset about? They signed for Herod, they're married, says Mutter, they're allowed to kiss each other. Rabbi Chanan says, Mimba Kukin Teda, take a look into the Torah. What are the last words in the Torah? The luchat that Moshe Rabbeinu broke, le'enei kol Yisrael. Sometimes when you do something in public, le'enei kol Yisrael, you're breaking the luchat. To kiss may be mutter, but not le'enei kol Yisrael. It's a meritic vote from Rabbi Chanan at the wedding. He went back to Europe. He wouldn't leave his yeshiva, wouldn't leave his children. And he was from the Litvisha, probably the most famous Rosh Yeshiva who still had many, many years in front of him to die in the Holocaust. What Hitler did to us, unbelievable. But this was Rav Henkin, this was his world. And Kainain Harach, he has many, many great and great-great-grandchildren of Atmat HaKodesh. It just breaks the heart, the Korbanot that were brought, that we have to bring to live here. I'll talk about this in America too, in a different context. And I have to say, we mentioned, yesterday's year was very, very, we dealt with a lot of side issues as well that come up in the Tshuvot. But you talk about Rabbi Luchstein, how they parcel out Rabbi Luchstein. So I have to tell you that in his kehila, he raised over $1 million to be put aside for the children of the martyred Henkin couple, so they'll be able to have higher education. There should be no problem with money for those kids later in life when they need higher education. Okay? So I agree, Rabbi Luchstein is left of center, but a frum Jew he is, 100%. Okay? I can't say everyone thinks like I do. I'm a centrist, all right? I still don't have a beard like Josef Krauss, like Yomo. We spoke about that yesterday. I just had Sherry send the letter out. I got it back.
Stop picking on Yomo.
I'm not picking on Yomo. I'm telling the facts. He has a right to say, Rebbe, we want you to have a beard and prayers and dress like a Rosh Yeshiva, like the Rebbeim dressed in Europe. You're a continuity of the great Rosh Yeshiva that brought Yiddishkeit from Europe to America, America to Israel. You're absolutely right. But my answer with the Mossad and Sahal, I saw you were quiet for once. It rang home. But I gave a tripod type answer, if you recall yesterday's shia. Okay. I want to go one step further. I have to say, it's very emotional for me. I have to be honest. I left YU in 1969. Rabbi Belkin made a farewell dinner. I have to be honest. I don't like to talk about myself. It's arrogant, but I had a very close relationship with Rabbi Belkin. Those of you who remember the 60s, he was totally removed from the student body. There were reasons why. And somehow there were reasons why we knew each other, had a close relationship. It had nothing to do with research or scholarship. It had to do with yours truly as a rabbi, as a speaker, as a teacher, as a Rebbe, Mrs. Manashevitz, and all that went with it. And he made a farewell. It was unheard of, a Rosh Yeshiva from YU going in Aliyah, and the man just got a doctorate. I was eulogized. I remember Sam Hotstein. And at the banquet, Dr. Belkin gets up to speak, and he says, Dr. Rotkoff, when you come back to America, there will always be a position for you in the yeshiva. Quote, end quote. What was he saying? He was echoing the Rav. No one could say, you're going to Israel, where are you going to succeed? Remember what the Rav said to me when I said, Rebbe, I'm going in Aliyah, how will you make a living? Yeah, Rav was honest, right on. And Dr. Belkin said to me, there'll always be a position for you at the yeshiva. So here I am in 69, getting off the boat. I've gone back a number of times, right where we got off the boat. It's still the same. Like, I still see how you come out and unwanted, uncalled, unsought. My wife, myself, three little girls. Jewish agency sitting there processing you. It was they were taking movies because it was the biggest amount of Aliyah from America on one boat. It was after the Six-Day War, 69. It was on the news. We saw the next day, we were at my Malka's brother and sister-in-law, and we saw it on the news, that the crowd coming off the boat, you know, and me'olel oleh, kocheinu oleh, and nevertheless, unwanted, uncalled, unsought. And here we are, 49 years later, And they need me in America to talk about the Rav, Baruch Hashem. God has been kind to us. And it has many, many implications. I just dealt with a picture. Well, let me be honest, though. I just dealt with a picture. Historic picture. The Yeshiva faculty, 1944. Mm-hmm. And there's one person in the picture. It says, unidentified. Unidentified. I'll tell you right away who that Rosh Yeshiva is. He was a Telsha, great Talmud Chacham, a wonderful Rebbe, a character, forced out of Europe. Rabbi Revel saves his life. Rabbi Revel had an affinity for Tels. Can anyone tell me why? Of course, the only yeshiva Rabbi Revel ever learned in for half a year was Tels. Outside of Tels, he is autodidactic. So he had an affinity for Tels. He brought him to America. And this person, you know, in Europe he would have been Echad Megidole Yisrael. Shmuel Yezavok, I can tell you his name, Rafok. Bucky and Kudshim Tarat. In America, he never really found himself. He's always thwarted. I'll give you a simple example. When they started recording the Rav in 56, it was my last year with Rav Volk. From there I went to the Rav a year later. And Rav Volker, well, and everyone was talking, they're recording the Rav Shurim. This was like an atomic bomb. And Rav Volker says, why don't they make a recording of my classes? Never. I said, Rebbe, a PhD from Berlin. The Rav has a PhD from Berlin. Ich hab gelernt in Gymnasium in Tells. And das ist mehr from a PhD. What we had to know to complete the Gymnasium, you know, never. So the years went by, and in 1960, Yosef, Dr. Krauss, the tragedy happened that Danny Greer pressed the Rav, and the Rav had to begin giving Shayurim in English. Write down that day that Rakefet describes in September 60 in the Rav, that's the end of Torah in the United States. Yitzchak, let me have it my way. You're so good, I haven't changed my mind. What do you want? They convinced me in Lakewood that Torah was given in Yiddish. Yes, if you're a kli shlishi, I'm a kli sheni. Get the difference? Okay. Yitzchak, can you live with that?
No.
Rabbi Reuben can't even live with that. Okay, have it your way.
Was he Ashkenaz or what kind of Yiddish?
Litvish or Galatziah? Well, no, the Rav was Litvish or Yiddish.
I'm talking about Moshe Rabbeinu.
Moshe Rabbeinu, I wasn't there, but I have to believe it was Litvish. But that's not the point. When the Rav switches to English, it's the death knell of the Rosh Yeshiva who can't manage it. You understand? This is a reality of life. So Rabbi Volk later has heart trouble, and he recovers. And he was a lot younger than I am. But he was of retirement age. And he wants to come back to the yeshiva. And the president of it, they won't let him come back. There are no students. Who's he going to teach? I found it, Rav Gerelich is retired. Rav Bunchstein is retired. Rav David Lifshitz reinvented himself. Who dibeh avrit v'ayu tamidim shekvar chazuru b'medirat Yisrael sheshotu b'yavrit. Ata tofeso te? Okay. So he was very angry. And he never forgave the yeshiva. He published two more volumes of the Sharei Tohar. These are his volumes, Shas, Paiskim, Kudshim, Tarot, Lumdis. His sons paid for it. His sons all did very well. Son-in-law, grandchildren in Lakewood from some of the family. Some are here, my next-door neighbors. Son married his granddaughter. Some are here. Unbelievable. And he was angry at the yeshiva. And in the introduction, he wrote certain things that are not nice. So people in the yeshiva decided to take revenge and wrote unidentified. You follow? I want to put out that picture and identify him. And I want to say something, Musadik, very important. In life, not all of us succeed. There's certain factors in life. To be the right person in the right place at the right time. Not all of us achieve it. I was in the rabbinate. I was not in the right place. Maybe I wasn't the right person. Maybe it wasn't the right time. My first shtala. It has tremendous implications what I went through as a kid of 23. Changed my gestalt. I hope for better. I've seen people, the right person in the right place at the right time, and they're idiots. But they were there. And then you see people, fabulous people. I mentioned one by name today, let me not spell it out. He never really found himself. If you know the history, his wife, Shem Dava, Nishmat. Her husband is an Adam Gadol, but he didn't find himself. You see in life, it's if you do find your nish, you have to be very humble and very thankful. And I absolutely bow my head, Mani Modela Kaddish Baruch Hu, that 49 years later I'm coming back to yeshiva and I don't need them to give me a job. Lehefech, they need me. just the opposite. It's a miracle in our times. I have much more to say about this with Divrei Torah, the Ben Ezra, Yetziat Mitzrayim, Dor HaMidbar, Dor Kanisat Eretz Yisrael. There's a lot to say. The Rambam, Kabbonot, Maron Vuchim, couldn't make peace without Kabbonot, and yet you don't want the Kabbonot will idolatrous practice, the ability to synthesize, to find your way. My dear students, what did we do today? All right, we did Ezra's Torah and Rav Henkin. I wouldn't miss the next class for all the matzah shmura that will be left over. All I know is every year I buy my daughter 5 kilo of matzah shmura, and believe me, as big as the crowd is at the Seder, we barely finish 2 kilo, a little bit more than 2 kilo. So when will the next, and we'll pick up exactly here. Agudas HaRabbanim, Mizrahi Aguda, what is happening? What were the 20s like? What was this golden era like? They're now more Americanized. Fascinating. The next class, whoever wants a memoir, is Monday, April 9th. There's no class that Sunday. Pesach ends on
Friday.
Shabbos is Ishru Chag, or second day Yontif for some other people who follow Rav Moshe's Plak. So there's no class Sunday, let them come back. But class begins on Monday, and that's where we are. And Dr. Kraus, that's one of your two last classes. And we got a break in someone reliable. Maybe you can explain to Dovovic how to turn, how to upload, maybe to Aryeh. Because people want to hear the shiur. If anyone wants a notice, there it is. There's a lot to be said. Oh, I have that to give out today. The story with Ne Yisrael. Remember I spoke about it last week? Is a hafach galim all over the world. It shows you Rakefet is not a bad judge of what's teretic and not teretic. A lot of people were upset. Let me just say that it was not Ne Yisrael itself. It was the Ne Yisrael High School. Although I don't consider that a compliment to the high school, at least it's not the Yeshiva Gavoha. Anyway, the children, I call them children, apologize, and you can see it all here. Near Yisrael, again, it's amazing what Chabad can come up with all the pictures. They removed the Purim mockery. Everything was taken down. They apologized. But, of course, it's a bad taste. How kids, who are you? What are you? I don't say Chabad or Kulam Tzaddikim, but never again, Ne Yisrael is not Kulam Tzaddikim either. I'll give you some good examples of what came out of Ne Yisrael. There's one individual I don't forgive until today who lives in Beit Shemesh, intellectually dishonest. There's no sin worse than that for Dobbenkeit. So please, look at the good, and the good of Chabad is overwhelming. Interesting article, the New York Times, Olam Kaminhogo Holeich. The Vatican Bank's ex-chief has just been indicted over $60 million embezzlement.
Wow. $60 million?
$60 million. Yeshiva University loses in the, what's it called, the payoffs, whatever, but there's a whole story here that their top player, they didn't allow to play because people accused him of having been paid in Israel for being a basketball player. And they say Yeshiva didn't have to be so strict, but they were worried about a Chilul Hashem. Here's the article on shaving by Rav Moshe Wiener, where he's trying to prove we all think the Litvakin shaved. Take a look at Rabbi Steinman, how he was opposed to people shaving. But you see, I think Rabbi Steinman's real reason is that if you have a beard, you'll be more hesitant to do a sin. Here's a whole article. I don't know how they found this. I told you. I once built a model Mishkan that I put together a model. Why you publicity? And here's all the information on the Mishkan. And in the article it says that the SOY wants to put my Mishkan on permanent display. And could you imagine if 55 years later they're asking me, do I know where it is today? Let me make clear, I do not know. And I built it for my children, but I brought it into class, and it's very Vayakob Kudei, it's in Yonah D'Yomah. This is an amazing article. They found a seal that they believe belonged to the prophet Yeshayahu. Very interesting article with pictures. Wow. Wow. Gosh. Something special. Oh, this is about New York Times, Polish nationalism, what they're doing with this new law, how it threatens all of Europe. Europe is trying to go on a different path. And here the Poles, right there with all that anti-Semitism up front. Very interesting article on Billy Graham, who died at the age of 99. And as you recall, his anti-Semitic remarks talking with the President Nixon. Were they really anti-Semitic remarks? Yeah, this is an interesting question. You know what locker room talk was all about? The president spoke about locker room talk. You see, sometimes Gentiles, they don't mean to be anti-Semitic, but they'll use the expression, don't Jew me down. You know, the Jews are good business people, you're bidding. But I don't know if that's an anti-Semitic remark. It's their false understanding of what Jews are like. All right? Could be we deserve it from the East Side peddlers. They used to, you know, the shtick they used to play. The father would yell to the son, Chaim, wiffle is der Kleidel? How much for this piece of clothes? And Chaim would yell back, 20 Taler, Tata, $20. And the father would say to the man, 10 Taler, $10. Like he didn't hear properly, and the guy thought he was getting a bargain. You follow? In reality, it was only worth $5. But he asked his son, how much is it? The kid yells, $20. He says, 10 Taler, yet gehet mein Sohn, you heard my son, $10. In reality, it was $5. So I don't, he apologized. I don't believe Billy Graham was an anti-Semite, but that's my opinion. Take it or leave it, I'm not an expert. This is about Adelson, God bless him, offering to pay for what the U.S. can't afford for the embassy in Jerusalem. Very interesting article. I tell you, the New York Times, outside of their hatred of Judaism and Israel, they're a fabulous paper. Here's an interesting article. Does it pay to execute the killer of the high school kids? And the whole problem with execution, how much money it costs, and to go through a trial, and the kids, all this becomes public again, and everyone suffers. Now, nice article about Donald Trump. I think I gave out a previous copy of this, that the evangelicals have found their president. On the other hand, Trump is not a tzaddik. This is who you're looking up to. It's an interesting article. Here, Limud in New York, what did they devote the class to? What the Me Too movement, what the Talmud can teach us about the Me Too movement, the Hillis, Lashon Hara, etc., etc. All right, very interesting. Up for auction, a portrait that we know to be the Chatam Sofer. And if you notice, it looks a little bit different than the usual pictures that are attributed. This was a portrait done in his lifetime.
And on the next page is a portrait of his wife.
The next page is a portrait of his second wife. It's his second wife. His first wife died young. You know who she was. This is Reb Kivega's daughter. And, there's stories about that shidduch. They're unbelievable. This is a very interesting article on the Shluchat conference about the problems that they have when they start their shlichut in the middle of nowhere. In a million years, I couldn't go to the... Imagine, Chabad makes me a shaluach to go to a place in China where there's not a drop of Yiddish guy, go and build. It's not for me, but kol hakavod. How to protect our schools. A haunting article, and this is Chabadnik writes, to educate, to give them a little meaning of religion. You know what the Rebbe fought for, never succeeded, introduce a few minutes a day of prayer, of nothing that's sectarian, but general. But all right, I don't know if you can win. And here's Chabad, the kids from Parkland, from where the massacre took place, they had a Shabbat for them at Chabad. I have a feeling some of them will pick up on Chabad, and before we know it, 10 years from now, we'll see stories on Shluchim whose lives were saved with long beards and payas doing what has to be done. My dear students, I want to wish you all a Chag Hashem Sameach. The truth of the matter is, for people like us, we have to say Chag Sameach B'Kasher, because we all work very hard. I see my wife already began Hanukkah timers every year, way beyond what one has to do. So first you have to say a Chag Sameach, please relax, enjoy the Chag, and it'll certainly be Kasher, B'Ezrat Hashem in Israel. What a bracha, what we have, the supermarkets, everything kasher, the Pesach, Osherad, beginning with Rosh Chodesh Nissan, I think it is, there's no chametz sold at all in Rami Levi. You have Kodesh V'chol, Mu'ud above him, Or V'choshech, Sholtim B'yachad. But Rami, in Osherad, I imagine in bingo in America now, no chametz after the first of Nisan. Yes, Yitzchak.
I think it's important that we as a class wish you well also, that you have a good, you should have a sense that you have a good audience wherever you go.
Right, well, that's the biggest problem. When I come into this classroom, I'm totally relaxed because Dalif Nimiyatom made. In America, Gutzel up Hitnam and so many different audiences, I have no idea what's going on. And the last Shabbos, which I agreed to be in at the bridge, what's it called, Fort Lee, so the rabbi already revised all my topics, and he said it's not an audience on that type of level. You follow? So Malka says you'll be back in Maplewood again. And yesterday I was answering Shilas from America from a relative. And Lanka is correcting me, explain yourself, don't use Hebrew, don't use Yiddish, he just knows English, you follow? So I got to remember, when I was at the Chabad convention after my first talk, they remember 2 years ago at that big outreach, and what a story that was. So the first time I spoke, again, I used Yiddish, Hebrew. From the second time on, I appointed a lady to stop me if I used any word other than English and have remind me to translate it. So Be'ezrat Hashem, it'll be interesting, and God should give strength, and we should survive the weather while you're basking in the sun. We're dealing with snow, and then Wednesday snow. But I told Malka, I looked ahead, 14-day forecast, the day before we leave, it's spring weather. It's hitting 50 degrees Fahrenheit. Until we meet, I'm going to miss all of you, but all right, we got to do what we have to do, and we'll come back, I hope, not with too many stories, with just Torah, and I'm going to have a lot to say on Sunday. The Eibishter should give strength, and the lectures are all different, so that you can follow me, except for Fort Lee. Fort Lee already, I can't win. I have to give just basic material. So until we meet again in health and happiness following the great Chag of Pesach, the Chag should be wonderful, the news from the Jewish people should be wonderful, and just Besorah Tova, Yeshuv Nechamot, Oleinu V'al Kol Yisrael, Das V'danya.